The city of Hamilton, Ontario, Stephen Brunt's longtime hometown, has a great, rich tradition of music and rock and roll. So I'm not sure of this connection to bring in Stephen. Andy?
Well, our very own Stephen Brunt right now is clad in a tux riding the GO train, I believe.
With Andy and John still, Mitch Melnick with you until 6, the debut of Frankie Corrado on Melnick in the Afternoon coming up ahead of the Canadians and Bruins. Stephen, please do explain more.
Well, yeah, I'm not quite there yet. I'm just about to get out at the train station here, so just out of an Uber here. So just give me a sec. But yes, I am dressed in my dinner jacket, etc., that I wear once a year, maybe twice, and I'm going to MC a charity dinner tonight in Toronto. So getting in and out of the city is such a schmozzle these days that there's no real choice but to do this. Anyway, it's fine. So, yes, I'm going to be sitting on a GO train in a tux.
And nobody will be staring at you.
Well, you know, it's, yes, I may stand out a little bit.
Tell me you are not going to be tempted to just jump out of your seat and then run full speed down the middle of the train at one point.
I like that. I should do something, right?
Anyway, you got to do something.
I'm still kind of adjusting to being in this garment right now, and, you know, every year kind of gives you a little kind of a verdict on, you know, what kind of shape you're in. So I'm and I fit in. I fit in one more time, so that's good.
So you have something in common with William Nylander.
Do I?
Yeah, well, he apparently takes the subway all the time, and he's.
Oh, that's right. Yes, he's a public transit deputy. That's correct. Yeah, sorry, I'd forgotten that. Yes, that would be that and our hair are the two things we have in common.
But he rides a lot and sweats. Not a tuxedo, apparently. So can you name the charity, what this is for?
Yeah, no, it's the Atlantic Salmon Federation.
Oh, of course.
The fish people, right? Yeah, so I, you know, I've been in Montreal for that dinner several times, and I'm on the board, and I am an angler, and they bring me in once a year to MC this. It's a small dinner, but it's the big donors. And I'm also the auctioneer. So
when did you acquire that skill?
Well, it's sort of, I think at a certain point they used to bring in real auctioneers, and then they said, you know, if we do that, we have to pay them, and, you know, that takes money away from the good cause. So what about this guy? Because he's here already anyway. See if he'll do it. And I've seen enough auctioneers, I guess. So yes, I'm imitating great auctioneers I've seen in the past, but I can't do that like the dibbity 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 thing. I don't do.
A Porky Pig?
That's like the best part of doing the auction.
Oh, man. I think the best, you know, Stephen's been, before the split between TSN and Sportsnet, it was such a treat to talk to him as often as we did. But to me, the most memorable conversation we had with Stephen is when he was talking about baby seals. Do you remember that?
I feel this might get me in trouble because
I don't want to get you in trouble, but it stands out when you talk about the charity. You know, it just stands out.
Yeah, no, I'm all for fish, and baby seals are lovely, but the big seals eat the fish, so fewer seals would be good.
Okay.
Is that the way you said it the first time?
No.
I didn't think so. Right? Like, there's lots of seals. They're not threatened. They're not that nice if you get up close to them. So yeah, if forced to choose, I would choose a fish.
Says a proud Newfoundlander. Okay, yeah, Rafael right. Nadal calling it quits. As we mentioned before, we teed it up for you that you could kind of, you saw this coming. Is this kind of a sad, slow decline of one of the greatest of all time?
Yeah, he's had injury problems almost his entire career, but yeah, certainly broken down, fought through it the last few years. But I think kind of a step back moment. You know, it's same as when Federer retired. That, you know, we have lived through and witnessed an era where the three greatest players of all time were playing at the same time, like playing each other. There's no, you know, you can talk about the equipment and earlier eras of guys playing with wooden rackets and Rod Laver or Bjorn Borg. and taking nothing away from them or from John McEnroe or Jimmy Connors or Pete Sampras or anybody else you want to talk about. But there's, you know, there's really not, it's not a debate. You can debate among the three of them, and they're, you know, three very different players and different strengths. But every one of them, all of them remarkable. And we've been, you know, if you like tennis, this is the most golden of golden eras. It's quite extraordinary what we've seen. And now we're down to one. And, you know, he's no longer the dominant player that he once was. So we're about to see the sunset on something that I'm trying to think of the equivalent in another sport. But, you know, people, like watching Bobby Orr and Wayne Gretzky playing at the same time. It doesn't tend to happen. These guys don't tend to overlap. And that's watching him play, especially watching him play, you know, in the French where he dominated. And I know if you look at his majors, it's, you know, very much weighted towards Roland Garros and playing on clay. But, you know, a tenacious player, obviously. And he's not someone I've ever interviewed. But everybody I know that's dealt with him speaks of him incredibly highly. In a sport where not everybody's a great person to deal with, people love this guy.
I'm just curious. He's the king of clay, Stephen, in another era where there is no Federer or no Djokovic. How great do you think he could have been with, you know, not playing two of the greatest, well, two guys who are, I think, ahead of him when it's all said and done? Is that it seems unlucky for him that he was placed in the same time frame as these guys who were just, in my opinion, just a little bit better than he was.
Yeah, I guess, I think you can kind of make the same argument about the other two guys, though, right? That you take away anybody, any of the three from this puzzle, and the other two are going to benefit, and they would have won more. You think of, you know, the head-to-head meetings, and you know, like, obviously clay was not Federer's greatest surface. But yeah, if you remove any of the three, the other two would have been, you know, even more head and shoulders above the field, you know, historically. And you know, the fact, it's a truth of the game that we don't measure that. It's not about whether you're the greatest hardcore player or the greatest grass player or the greatest player on clay. We kind of expect all the really great ones to win on all three. You know, not everybody's made for that equally. But yeah, if you take him out of the equation, Federer and Djokovic are in another stratosphere. If you take one of those two out of it, you know, he probably wins a few more Wimbledons or US Opens or the Australian Open. I have a favorite among the three, but I'm not sure I would feel comfortable standing back and saying here's the order 1, 2, 3. I think because they all beat each other on a given day, it's, you know, very, very, very hard to choose.
Yeah, how dare you? How dare you speak the truth? Rather than get into a great forced debate, he's better than he is, and that's the way I feel, and that's the truth. And if you don't agree with me, you're an idiot.
Yeah, I just broke the cardinal rule of sports radio. Is that what you're saying?
Not on this show, no. Did you catch the Rick Westhead in-depth interview with Kevin Blue, the chief executive of Canada Soccer? And if so,
yeah,
what's your takeaway?
Well, yeah, I did, and you know, Rick's been leading on this story, so. I'm glad that, cause I was kind of wondering when somebody was going to step up and say, hey, what's going on with your investigation? It's been a while. It's gotten awfully quiet. I hope more people start pressing, not just reporters, but some of the funders and people who are stakeholders with the national teams. They would look, what's going on here? Like this, you know, we identified a huge problem here. This has been a huge black mark on the program and on the sport in Canada. And there are a whole bunch of unanswered questions, and when are we going to get answers? You would understand that from, you know, if you were running Canadian soccer right now, you'd prefer this whole thing just went away and people forgot about it and they just talked about Canada-Panama next week or something on the pitch. And I understand what Kevin's saying, that, you know, it's an independent investigation. We don't control it. We don't control the timeline. We have to wait. That's the whole point. And it does have to be independent. It does have to be arm's length. You don't want them investigating themselves here. But yeah, I do. I do think it's a legitimate question to ask. It seems to be taking a whole long time. It's, you know, especially in terms of the women's program, where Bev Priestman's still status is still, she's kind of in weird limbo. Again, I expect she's going to get fired officially, but she's currently in limbo. You'd think, you know, to kind of move on here, you got to get some answers. And I look, I don't think it's going to get swept under the rug. I don't think that's possible. But I, you know, again, the rest of the interview, I thought Kevin was pretty forthright about kind of the situation he walked into, as forthright as he's going to be. Now, it's a weird situation. Somebody else actually took the job before him and then quit before she started the job, because I think, you know, I'm not sure what the official explanation was, but it sure seemed like she stepped in and said, whoa, this is worse than I thought it was going to be. But, you know, he's not going to get into the minutiae of the negotiations with the Canada soccer business, et cetera, or with the teams. But, I think, you know, look, jury's out, and he can't take – certainly can't take credit for what happened with the men's team, the kind of miracle of the last few months. But I'm hopeful that he's the right guy. You know, I think we've kind of all got to give him a chance here.
I'm curious, in the months ahead, what have you made of, you know, just staying on the pitch for the men's side? Jesse Marsh, we're hoping to have Jesse, you know, join us at some point over the next not so little bit, because they're here in Montreal. Him really trying to use the power of opportunity for Canada, and kind of for guys who are kind of dual nationals, giving them a real chance to actually have an ability to be main focal points for the Canadian team, where he's been kind of unapologetically saying, look, you're going to be getting more time on the pitch if you come join us. And I'm curious to see how much this is going to be able to work in the months ahead.
Yeah, I love it. Like, it's a lot easier to do that after coming, you know, finishing fourth in the Copa against all expectations and playing well in the friendlies in Europe and rising up, you know, whatever the FIFA rankings matter. Like, it's easier where if people think, boy, this is a program on the rise, and I'm going to commit my international future to Canada if I have an option. But, you know, it's been an issue historically, you know this, but Canada lost players who opted out of playing for Canada because they thought the program was hopeless. And they wanted to play in a World Cup, and they thought, there's no chance I'm playing in a World Cup when I'm playing for Canada. That's what Owen Hargreaves, why he made that decision. Made him a villain in Canada, but I understand the decision at the time. The program was a mess. So, no, I love the idea of Marsh getting out there on the front foot. And the other thing is, you know, look at that squad, you know, these matches coming up next week. I mean, look at the squad he's chosen. Like, all the key guys are there, but there's a lot of young players. And, you know, he is giving players opportunities. He did give players opportunities almost immediately when he took over that weren't getting a shot before. And, you know, I think it's been a bit of a revelation for me. I don't know if it is for you, John, but just that the depth of talent is greater than I thought it was. You know, I think there's more there than it felt like leading, you know, even in the run-up to Cotter when they had all that success. It kind of felt like, you know, the guys who were there, but there's not much beyond this, and they're going to have to play guys who are, you know, probably a little over the hill because that's all they've got. You know, it feels much – there's a youth and an energy to it, but also a ton of talent. Again, not overstating it. Like, I don't think they're going to go win the World Cup, but it's – you know, maybe it's just coming in with a fresh set of eyes and saying, hey, hang on, how come this guy's not playing?
Yeah, what's impressive to me is, you know, like the best teams, and Canada, to your point, is not going to be one of the best teams, but some of the best teams out there, it's, oh yeah, we have this very pronounced weakness. There is no left back to play for this country, or, you know, we don't have a striker, even though we're really, really good, or we only have a striker if you're like Poland or something like that. But what surprised me is not just the depth of talent, but the way that the country seems to be getting lucky in the talent in the positions that they need, where, you know, now you have players seemingly in the years ahead that you can envisage filling roles that at the moment you were thinking, this seems like a weakness, and then boom, this guy pops up and wow, all right, maybe he's that guy to pick up the mantle and run with it.
Yeah, no, that's right. That's that is the way it feels. And I think, again, it started for me with the fact that, hang on, we got two center backs that weren't playing, that, you know, can play at this level and weren't given a chance. And God love Stephen Vitoria, but you know, he was on his last legs, and John Herdman played him into the ground, and these guys were standing there not getting an opportunity. Like, that's, for me, was the first great revelation, and it's kind of gone on from there.
Final one for Stephen Brunt, CFL Reporters Hall of Fame, class of 2007. It's Thanksgiving weekend coming up. Owls will be hosting Ottawa on the Mountain. It's usually a great time of year for the CFL as we get ready for the play.
Labor Day and Thanksgiving were the kind of the two, you know, signposts on the way to the Grey Cup.
But something happened this past week that has never happened in the CFL.
Yes.
Both teams from Alberta are out.
Yeah. And Edmonton has had a bad run in the last several years. They've got new ownership. They're going to private ownership. That might help. They went through the whole Chris Jones experiment. That didn't work. So the fact that they're out is not totally shocking, but Calgary, you know, has been consistently, not necessarily a great cup contender every year, but they've been in the playoffs for forever. And that whole program there seems I'm not sure where they're headed. They were bad this year. And, you know, you think of the kind of quarterback succession that they had in that city going back, you know, Flutie and Dickinson and Garcia and, you know, right up through Bo Levi Mitchell. And, you know, Jake Mayer doesn't belong on that list. So I think that's the shocker. Edmonton's still a work in progress. I hope Trey Ford turns into a star. But I don't know what's going on in Calgary. And, John Huffnagel's been there for a million years, as kind of the guy at the top of the pyramid. But, you know, you wonder if there's a big shakeup coming there.
Enjoy the seal appetizer tonight, Stephen. Please take pictures and send us.
I will take a picture of those little dewy eyes staring back at me.
Brought to you by Champlain Taxi every Thursday after 4:00. 271-1111, award-winning writer and broadcaster, Mr. Stephen Brunt.